There's a comic I once saw a number of years ago, Calvin and Hobbes. So those of you who are fans, Calvin and Hobbes is about a young boy, Calvin, and his pet or play tiger, which he imagines is alive. And it has very insightful points into human character. And there was one particular one in which Calvin was playing with a worm, and he was fighting over it with his pet tiger. And his father said to him, they were fighting over it. So his father said, "Listen, let me sort it out for you. I'll cut the worm in half." You know, he expects Calvin to be very, you know, apprehensive about that. And he says, "That's so cool. Can you do it? Let me go get another one." And so, you know, and his father was like, his father thinks back to, you know, the, you know, Solomon may not have been dealing with the same characters as his son. And so what I'd like to discuss with you this morning is a Haftorah, which actually comes up very, very rarely. Miketz actually does have its own Haftorah. Parshas Miketz, which we're about to enter, does have its own Haftorah. It happens to be that Haftorah is not read very, very frequently. The last time it was read, the last two times, was in 1977 and in 2001. And the next, and it was not Thanksgiving. Thank you so much.
When you have two Shabbos Chanukahs,
there's two Shabbos Haftorahs for Chanukah. Well, Yeshu gets the first one. There's a second one from Shlomo HaMelech in the Binyan Abayis. However, very, very infrequently, it happens to be that in the 19-year cycle, that it will come out that Miketz will end up not being on Chanukah. Very unusual. The next time that will occur is in 2021. But until then, there's a very unknown Haftorah, which is the actual real Haftorah of Miketz, and that is the story of Shlomo HaMelech. So, if I could just draw your attention, we all know the story, but just a few points as we appreciate this. The story actually occurs after a dream. And that perhaps is the connection to the parasha, is that the Haftorah starts with Vayikatz Shlomo Vihinei Chalom. He woke up and there's a dream, which sounds very similar to with Paro, right? Vayikatz Paro Vihinei Chalom. And what happens? Vayavoh Yerushalayim Vayamod Difnei Aron Bris Hashem Vayal Olos Vayas Shlamim Vayas Mishteh L'Kol Avodov. So he makes an entire feast for all of his servants. Now, what dream is it referring to? What did Shlomo just wake up out of? So you go back into Melachim over here. What actually just occurred was the famous dream in which Shlomo HaMelech was offered by God anything. He could ask for anything: riches, health, longevity, whatever it would be. And Shlomo HaMelech asked for an understanding heart. That's what Shlomo HaMelech asked for. And Hashem was so impressed by the request of this human being that he said, because of that, I'll grant you all of them. And so immediately after this dream, as he's granted this incredible wisdom, what happens? He wakes up, and this is the first thing to occur. So obviously that this occurrence, this incident which occurs, and the few that follow it, are expressions of the fact that he just received wisdom from God. Right? So just to put it into context. And what happens? Then we are told, Oz tavona shtaim nashim zonos el hamelech, v'atamod alafonav, and two women who are either prostitutes, innkeepers, depends what we understand in this particular context, come before the king and they say, v'atomer ha'isha achas, bi adoni, ani v'ha'isha azos yoshvos b'vayis echad v'aylech ima b'vayis. We live in the same house, and after 3 days after my birth, the second woman also had a child. We are the only two inhabitants of this apartment. And the child, the Rachmana Litzlan, the child of the one lady dies. And it says, Asher Shachva Alav, she lay on him. It's interesting, it must have been a sleep-related incident, unfortunately. And she switched her dead child with my live child, and as if to say that in the morning it was my child that had died. I see the child's dead, but I know it's not my child. The second woman responds, No. It's my child who's alive and yours is who is dead. Another one responds, your son is dead, my son is alive. And they spoke to the king. Another one responds saying, the responses
Shlomo HaMelech repeats their responses. In fact, the Gemara learns from over here that it's important for a judge to repeat the claims. Right? It's important in speaker listening techniques in general, without even being a judge. When speaking to people, you have no idea how important it is just to repeat what people say. No judgments, no questions, no, just to repeat what they say in terms of understanding it. It's a validation. That's what Shlomo HaMelech does. Vayomer HaMelech, and there is a slight difference. Vayomer HaMelech, kuchuli cherev, vayavoa cherev lifnei HaMelech, bring me a sword and bring it in front of the king. Vayomer HaMelech, gizru sayered achai, dishnai mutnu esachatzila el achas, esachatzila achas. Give one half to each woman. Vayotomer ha'isha asher b'no achai el HaMelech,
so the woman who's really the mother says, don't do this. You know, I prefer to have the child alive, not in my hands, rather than to be dead in my hands.
The other woman says, no. If it's not going to be my child, I don't want him alive even. Cut him in half.
The king said, give it to the one who wanted the child not to be killed, because she is the real mother.
And the conclusion of this whole section is, Vayishmu kol Yisrael el es ha-mishpala she-shafat ha-melech, Vayiru'u mipnei ha-melech, ki ra'u ki chochmas elokim bikirbo la'asos mishpat.
It's not just put here. Randomly, the story is clearly an expression of what he just received, the wisdom of the king. That's what's occurring over here. Fascinating story. And that's the end of the Haftarah. That's all we have. And one has to question... We want us to question this on a number of levels. First of all, what's going on? How does Shlomo Melech really know what's going on? Like, how does he know that this will be a successful acid test in the first place? Does he have grounds for this in the first place? There's a number of different ways of looking at this. The earlier Mefarshim have a particular way of looking at it. The Radak says in very simple terms that, I'm quoting Chazal in the second source, he imo kevin shemerachemes alav.
Simply, what was happening over here? He's just using this test to get a sense of the mercy of one mother as opposed to the other, and that was the way of understanding what was really going on. Interesting. The only issue is, one has to keep this question in the back of our minds, is that this is an expression of the great wisdom of Solomon the king, of Shlomo HaMelech. Is that really true? Is this something which one of us could not have thought of ourselves? Now, you might tell me yes, meaning it's very extreme. It's an extreme expression of this. But surely that this point seems to be an obvious one enough that why was this something that we'll call it the hallmark of Shlomo's wisdom, which is expresses itself, as understood by the Radak and the earlier Mefarshim, that he was just trying to get a sense of who had greater mercy. That's the question which should really be at the back of our minds over here. Which is what leads the later Mefarshim to more complex analysis. The Barbanel suggests, and he brings in an interesting Pirush over here in Source 4, the Barbanel suggests something very interesting, which was perhaps off the radar screen, and he says, V'acherim omrim. That's in the end of the first line in the actual text, which is at the bottom of the page. V'acherim omrim, others say, Sheshlomo kasher shoma shel isha ha'achas, shochvo al bonoi v'him yisosai. What happens? Shlomo HaMelech hears that there wasn't a regular death. The death was that the mother somehow lay on the child in such a way that the child died. So Shlomo HaMelech listens to that, and he says, Hoshev shetiyah isha hu hahi mitevo ma'adim asher yase makas cherev vehereg v'avadon. So he understands that there must be, whether consciously or subconsciously, this lady must be more, have a proclivity more towards violence, or we'll call it lack of care. And therefore, Lachen Amru Achai, Hachen Nicherev, bring me a sword, Va Omar, Gozrues, a Yered Achai, and he all wants to cut up the child. Uvir also shall Isha Hachashuda, Omra, Gam Li, Gam Loch, Lo Yee, Gozuru, Hisametsos Loi, Shehi Hosomi Teva Ma'adim. He understood, not from the lady who has the Rachamim on the child, but from the lady who's prepared to kill the child, that there must be something more violent about her. There must be something about a greater or a lesser degree of care of human life. And that was what he was looking for. Interestingly enough, it's the opposite to what the Radak was saying. The Radak was looking for the mercy of the one woman. He's looking for the violence of the second woman. That's what Shlomo HaMelech is seeing over here. Tachpots becherev uv'gzirah sayela. That's why she wanted the death. V'i amora And that showed shehi hamhimisa esanar b'shachva aleha. Ki adavar kulam mimin echad morim ze al ze umikan yisbar etzloi mihaisa eim hayelel achai b'tziva lesit alai. And that's how he worked out who the mother was. So the Mepharshim struggle, is it because of the extra mercy? Is it because of the extra lack of care which he sees subconsciously in this woman? Now notice the interesting point, that it's not that this woman necessarily, we'll call it, intentionally killed the child. But the point is that a person who lives their life with a lack of care of human life is going to be one who's more likely to have such an incident. The example given is that with the famous Gemara in Makos about the Arei Miklat. There's an unfair division of the Arei Miklat. There are three in Israel proper and three on Transjordan, whereas there's 9.5 tribes on Israel proper and only 2.5 tribes on Transjordan. So the Gemara says, why the difference? The Gemara says, because in Gilad, in Transjordan, in the East Bank, Nefishi Rotzchim, there were many murderers. That doesn't explain the Arei Miklat. The Arei Miklat weren't primarily for murderers, although everybody would run there at the beginning. But afterwards, they were only a safe haven for the people who were killed by Shogeg, unintentional murderers. So the common explanation given is if you're in a society in which murder is more prevalent, then of course you're going to be less attuned to sensitivity of life, and they're going to be more in unintentional murders as well. The similar kind of thing what Shlomo Melech is looking for here. He's trying to look into the nature of the person. This adds a little bit over here. However, it still really is troubling, is that these are things one can... we'll call it regular human beings could have intuition into. Regular human beings could look into this and see it. Where was the chokhmah of Shlomo over here? And therefore, that's why the Abarbanel himself, and later on the Radvaz, David ben Zimra, who discussed this matter in greater depth, actually points to a little bit of a nuance over here. The way the Abarbanel says it himself, because he rejects this previous pirush, and he says, starting on the top of the second page, Amitasa inyan hava ledaiti. What is the truth of the matter? V'ushe Shlomo hisig amitasa davar hazeh kodem hanisayan v'abechina hazot. What happens? Shlomo realizes what's really going on when? Before it even starts. Before he asks to put out the sword, before he makes the adjudication, he knew what was going on. How so? Ki ma'akoras p'nei hanashim hazonos, when he looks at their faces, when he sees their characteristics, and their way of speaking, when he heard them, he understood, he went down to the depth and the truth of the matter. And what happens? At that point in time, he tells the people around them, He whispers to the people standing around him, you know, I think it's Lady A. I think it's Lady A who's the real mother at that point. And those around him, because of their we'll call their body language, even the way the Rabbi Barmanel is describing this. Why did he do the experiment? To prove his intuition. And very interesting. The experiment wasn't the point of realization. The experiment was simply proving his analysis. And therefore he tells the people beforehand and shows them that he's correct via this. The Radvaz, actually, Rav David ben Zimra, adds a few nuances to the story as well. He says, by the looks, looking at the child and the mother, and an ability to be able to associate, which it's true when you look at a baby and everybody says, oh, he looks just like you, and right? But imagine you had to identify a baby to two mothers. It's not so simple. So he's looking at the child and identifying to one mother. Also, the nature of the woman and the background of the relationship. He asked him about the background of the relationship, and through all this intuition, he was able to understand it. So what does it mean when everybody saw the Chochmah of Shlomo? It's not referring to us looking at the story. It's referring to the people around him at the time who realized that his intuition was correct. And that was what was going on. That was why the story was so important at this particular juncture. And while explaining this, in fact, the Radvaz explains that there is an extra added aspect of it, and there's a relationship. There's a relationship issue, and this is very fascinating because over here it's very unusual. It's very unusual when you look at the claims as well. There is actually a bit of a flip in terms of the description, right? They're both arguing that their child's alive. But when you look at the way they describe it, they flip the way they describe it. One lady says that it's my child is alive and your child is dead. The second one said it's your child who's dead and my child who's alive. Do you see that they actually flipped the way they described it, which leads Shlomo Melech, says the Radvaz, to think it must be that one of the women wants the child dead. Right? What do you always say at the beginning of when a person is making an argument, you say the strongest part of your argument first. So it sounds like one of the women's more intent upon the child being dead than being alive. Isn't that interesting? That's what Shlomo Melech notices in just the way they describe it. Now, why would somebody want the child dead? So he starts asking, what's the relationship? What's going on over here? How's this child related to you? How are you related to one another? And the Meiri points out, this is the Meiri in Yevamos, points out a very striking and terrifying underlying story over here. This is the following. V'u'inyan sh'ne'emar b'hagoda al oson sh'taim nashim. There's a story about the two women, Zonos Shebola Din Lifne Shlomo Ame Shlomo, Shareka Shitziva Shlomo, Ligzore Sayeled Achai, Veshiva Achas Tnulon Lo Esayelod Achai, Vahames Altimisuhu. When you saw that the woman would prefer not to kill the child and rather give it to the other woman, Hoyaroila Acheres, La Shiv Es Sheli, Hinosenes Li. What should the response of lady number two be? Here, orders are very important. Woman number one says, don't kill him. Don't kill him. Give him to the other woman. What should the response of woman number two be? I'll take it. Thank you so much. Right. Now, she's broken. She didn't call the bluff, right? So what should she have done? She should have said, thank you so much. You recognize the truth. What does she do? She doesn't. She wants it dead. She's giving me my child. When she says, chop the child in half, it was a mistake on her part. And Shlomo therefore recognized in this matter, why does she want the child dead? These women were actually related. It was a mother and a daughter-in-law. We found this out from the relationship that he was talking. There's a mother and a daughter-in-law. Umesu ba'alei, and they both died, their husbands passed away. Beloi bonim, acherim, elo elu hashnaim. I mean, it's a terrible situation. They're obviously both pregnant and their husbands both pass away. And they're living together. And they both have these children. Umesu yeled shel zehakala. And in truth, it's the daughter-in-law's child who dies first. V'kol shemes toch shloshim nidon kenefel. And because it was such an early birth, what in halachic literature is understood to mean, this is a nefel, this is a child who wasn't destined to have a full life. It's as if halachically she didn't have a child for certain halachas. What are those certain halachas regarding? Yibum. It's as if she's a childless mother. She now necessitates yibum. Baharehi zekuka liyibum. She requires yibum. Ukishemotso atzmo tzricho lahamtin loisoi yeled shel chamoso. And now what happens? Is there a brother? Is there a brother to her husband? Yes, he was just born. But he's only a few weeks old. A few days old, in fact. So what's going to happen? In the case of, like, remember what Naomi says to Rus. Don't wait, even if I had a child now. Because you have to wait 13 years. This woman would have to wait 13 years. Right? Either for Chalitz or Yibum, whichever one. She'd have to wait till this child is of halachic status. Right, therefore, he chlifo achai b'meis kedei lomar shebeno hu. She wanted the child to be hers, but he poter mishnei stadim, and she wanted to get rid of the yibum from both sides. So number one, that she has a child, and number two, that there's no uncle. Shere tomar sheyesh lo ben ve'en lo yobam. Ukeshe omar Shlomo gozru esayilad achai. Smeicha mipnei shenoe choye lo bekach kedei linose beheter v'hirgish Shlomo b'inyan zeh. And what is she therefore? If the option was given that the child should be killed, She thought this is the best solution, because in this sense there's no yibum, there's no possibility, because there's nobody to marry, and that's why she was intent upon this. And Shlomo, looking into her words, understood this. Both at the beginning of her very initial words, and as expressed in the experiment itself. And that's perhaps one of the depths of what is going on over here. But the problem with this entire framework of a yes.
The reason this got to Shlomo, I assume at that time they also had different levels of court, must have been that the people below thought it was a tough one.
Right, it must have, yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, we said that someone had an answer, it must have been...
Right, correct. It must have obviously been something which was not so simple to work out. And must, in order to have reached Shlomo, it's hard to know the context, because all we have over here is he wakes up and these women come in front of him. And we don't know the context of that. Was it immediately afterwards? What was the, you know, was he walking in the street and they caught, you know, like, so it's hard to know how it got you. But yes, you're right. In the judicial system, it would have to actually make its way up the tiers. And this was obviously one of the most difficult cases, which perhaps adds to the fact that his intuition was proved correct, even without doing anything before. So your point well taken, Sebi. The problem that we have over here is the following. Is that according to what the Abar Banel and the Radvaz are doing, effectively, is that they're now saying that this judgment was based not primarily on the evidence necessarily, but intuition effectively. Right? What they're doing is they're moving away from the fact that the experiment itself proved it. And what are they doing? He's showing that it's really based on his intuition. And there's a problem with that. There's a problem with that, and that is in halachic literature in general, we do not change our halachic status based on an umdana. An umdana is an assumption or an assessment based on a judge. And so how does this even work? How is it possible to for Shlomo HaMelech to even done this if such is the truth? If such is the truth. I want to thank Abby for sending me a very beautiful email last night with a beautiful piece he put together from based on the Nachlos Shimon, Rav Krasner, who actually from Neri Yisrael, who has an incredible set on Nach. And he takes sugyas throughout Nach, and he does a full, very full service to every sugya, and he deals with this over here. And Abby has a beautiful piece which he put together in terms of this particular dealing. And in fact, you should know, until last night, I was actually thinking of giving the shir based specifically on this sugya. But it is a huge sugya, because really what one has to effectively do is go through all the sugyas in Shas, and Baba Basra, and Baba Kama, all these cases, and understand how umdana does or doesn't affect, and what type of umdana. It was an umdana hamuchach, umdana not a which is not muchach, and what degree of umdana factors into court. So with Abby's permission, this is a beautiful piece. If you're really interested in seeing, it's very well summarized over here in terms of the three opinions in terms of where one lies in terms of what type of umdana and how one assesses that. What I'd like to do today is actually a bit of a tangent, and I'll tell you why I think this is very significant. I decided that this would be perhaps tonight for us today would be more. More important in terms of a specific model which is drawn out over here, and that is I just to draw your attention to the Radvaz, who does suggest these answers very briefly. He doesn't go into them into great depth in source 6. He says v'im tomar ha kaimalon kamanda amar lo mafkinam amona bechazak asay elo be'edim v'raya. You need to have Adim, you need to have official, there needs to be an official way to extract money. Even though we have a case of an umdana demuchach, that we know for sure, kahi de gamal ha'ocher ben agmalim. You see a very wild camel, so Gemara in Baba Basra Tzadi Gimel, that you see a very wild camel, and it's running around the herd, and then you find a dead camel belonging to somebody else. What do you do in that case? So the Gemara discusses whether you can assume that the wild camel was the one that killed, because of its, you can see now, it's still in such a state that it was the one that effectively killed it, but you don't know, nobody was there. That's the Gemara's discussion there. And you don't say you take money away from somebody based on that. We don't even listen to a baskol. We don't believe that. So we don't listen to that for halachic purposes. So it says the Radvaz three potential answers, and he says them very quickly. Very interesting point. Once the first woman says, take him, what has she done? She has relinquished what rights on that child. She no longer has, we'll call it the chazaka, that she actually has it. Shlomo's not extracting money, he's simply taking now an abandoned child effectively, because the mother's abandoned him effectively, and to give it and adjudicate where it goes based on his umdana. Very fascinating point, number one. Says the Radvaz, yes.
I don't understand the point. If she gives up,
yes,
there's less of a reason for Shlomo to say split the baby, no?
No, Shlomo Melech has already said split the baby. Number one says,
okay,
I'll give it up. So at such a point, it's no longer, there's nobody who has a chazaka more than the other one, because she's given up her rights to it. Now Shlomo is able to adjudicate based on his thought process. Inami, this is a specific dealing at the time that he felt that it was necessary to prove a point, which diminishes in a certain sense from the Chochma Shlom, if you think about it being Haraz Shah. It means to say that's not the regular way things are done. Vaviyodeya, and he says, Shiesh mi sheposek demafkinon mamona beumdana demuchach. Some people say you can extract money based on umdana demuchach mikomako meha uvda leka mohechrecha. It's not necessarily a proof from our case. What interests me is the following, is that I was thinking about this case, and I thought that there might be another possibility over here. And I was very excited to find out that the Rashba actually suggests it. And that is a very fascinating concept. The Rashba was sent a letter from a particular group of people who were appointed by the town, and the town said, listen, we want people to be our spiritual guardians, our spiritual policemen. And you form a coalition, you form a council, and anybody who does anything in this town incorrectly, you'll be the people to adjudicate. And these people sent a question to the Rashba saying, what do we do based on circumstantial evidence? Meaning we know that, XYZ was at such a place and did such and such a thing, but we don't really have Aiden, we don't have Asra, we don't have... So what are we able to, punish him based on the hearsay of the street? That was what the question that came to the Rashba. And the Rashba lines up all the halachas of Eidos, and he says the following. He says, She'en based in Malkin Elo Acher Asra. We only get Malkus if there's a valid Hasra. There needs to be a warning. Elo Shebechol Elo Advorim Enom Elo based in Hanagim Al Pitora. But that's true when you're going to Beis Din, and Beis Din is acting based on Torah law. Halot Yiru, David Shehorag Al Pi Atzmo Ger HaMoleki. But you'll see that David HaMelech didn't stick to that. What happens is, David HaMelech finds his refugee from the battle, and the refugee tells him that what happened was Shaul HaMelech was dying in battle and asked him to be killed, right? And this person said that he ended up finishing up Shaul HaMelech because Shaul was scared to be captured by the Plishtim and be killed and tortured by the Plishtim, which was a valid thing because they actually took his body and hung it up very disrespectfully. So what happens? Nezger HaMoleki ends up killing Shaul HaMelech, and based on his own hearsay, what did David HaMelech do? He kills the Ger HaMoleki. Wait a second. What happened to Adim? What happened to Asra? How could David HaMelech do that? You see that there is place to punish outside of judgment, the regular din, not to transgress Torah. There's place to make a fence for the Torah. We'll get to that in a second. What the Rashba is pointing out is that there's law, and there is law, and this is very important. This is an exceptionally important point. Because when one reads through the Gemaras, when one goes through Sanhedrin, when one goes through Makos, one comes out with perhaps a mistaken perception. One comes out with a mistaken perception. Here's one example of what could create this mistake. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following. This is a Mishnah. This is based on the Mishnah on Daf Mem Amud Beis in Source 8. Tana Rabbanan. These are the questions that witnesses are asked. Makirim Atem Osoi. Do you recognize the person, the victim, or the murderer? Nochri Harag, was the victim non-Jewish? Yisrael Harag, was he Jewish? Hesrei Simba, did you give him Hasra? Meaning, did you warn him that this is punishable specifically by death? Kibel Olav Hasra, did he accept it? Meaning, did he acknowledge your warning? Hitirat Smo Lemisa, did he say, I'm going to accept that, and therefore knowing that I'm going to die? Hamis Besoch Kededibor, did he kill within the span of 3 seconds of that warning? Ha'oved Avodah Zorah, es mi Ovad. Do you know which specific deity he served? Lefor Ovad, Lemarkulos Ovad, did he serve Pa'or? Or Mercury, did he serve Bame Ovad? How did he do it? Bezivuch, Zivuach, Bekitru, Benisuch, Bashtachavo. Very specific questions. And the kind of perception you get from learning the Gemara in Sanhedrin is, and as it expands, is how are you ever going to have a successful court case? If you have such specific questions, how are you ever going to get a person to the end of the line? And in fact, that's what the Gemara in Makos says, really the Mishnah says. The Mishnah tells us on the end of the first parak, this is the end of the Mishnah, Sanhedrin Ha'areges, this is in Source 9, Echad B'Shavua Nikres Chavlanis. A Sanhedrin which would kill a person one every 7 years would be considered a murderous Sanhedrin, a violent Sanhedrin. Rabbi Eliezer Ben Azaria Omer, Echad L'Shivim Shana, even once in 70 years. That means to say, effectively, that day we're talking about the span of the Beis Hamikdash. Think how many misses it's referring to. Very few. Rabbi Tavon, Rabbi Akiva Amrim, Ilu Ayinu B'Sanhedrin Lo Elen Erag Olam Me'olam. Rabbi Tavon, Rabbi Akiva said, if we were part of that Sanhedrin all the way through and made sure that nobody was ever killed, that's how specific they would have been. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Amrim, Af Hein marbim shofcheh dami v'Yisrael. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel responded, if you did such, you would allow much murder, because there's no accountability for your actions. And that's the Gemara at the end of that mission over there explains the specific questions that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tavon would ask. They would ask very specific minutia as to every act, just to make sure that everything was 100% seen by the Edim, to the point that you could effectively never get there. I mean, imagine how many times are you going to have somebody in the heat of the moment who's going to be able to hear the Hasra, accept the death, and say Avo Pichain, and kill within 3 seconds. He could just wait 4 seconds and still, right, and it's not Tokid Edibor, and still not be liable for Misa. So how does such a system work? How does such a system work? One gets the perspective from these Gemaras and these Mishnais that the basin wasn't an operational system in terms of society. And that's why this is dealt with by many people, but most notably by Rabbeinu Nissim. Rabbeinu Nissim, one of the later Rishonim in the 1400s, wrote a many Pirushim, but one of the things he wrote was what's called Drosha Saran. His Droshas, and you know, if you think a Drosha going 12 minutes is long, you should look at these Droshas Aran. Right? So the Droshas Aran was a serious Drosha. This wasn't Shabbos Shuv or Shabbos HaGol, but this was a serious Drosha. And he has it based on a lot of the Parashios. In Drosha Yud Aleph, it's based basically primarily on the Sefer, on the Parasha of Shoftim. And he has a very interesting essay over there. And at the beginning of his piece, he points out, he discusses exactly this point. And he points out that there were two arms of the judicial system in Israel. Two different distinct parts. Number one was, and as he describes in the Pasuk, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'chol shorecha. You shall put out Shoftim and their policemen in all your gates. Hashem Hashem lokecha nasein lecha lishvatecha. That God's giving to your tribes. V'shoftu es al mishpat tzedek. What should they do? They should judge mishpat tzedek. There are many pirushim what that means. What does mishpat tzedek mean? Says the Drosha Zaran, what this means to say is that the court, the Beis Din, is not there to keep society in check. Beis Din is there to express the knowledge of God in society. It's almost more ritualistic than social. Right? And therefore, that's why it is that the Mishnah Midos tells us, a famous point, that Lishkas HaGozis, in source 12, Shom Hoysa Sanhedre Gedola Shel Yisrael Yosheves V'Dona Esakuna. Where was the pinnacle of this system of Beis Din? Where was the highest court seated? In the Beis HaMikdash next to the Mizbeach. This wasn't a system of society being kept in check and that their crime rates need to be dropped. We're talking about, what is the main primary focus? Mishpat Tzedek. Mishpat Tzedek. God says, if you deal with my people, you need to deal with them in a certain way. That's why it is that we know that the din of a pruta is kedin me'ah, right? That even if somebody comes to court and it's a very difficult court case, and the point that they're arguing about is a few cents, that's given equal assessment or equal time in the eyes of the law, in terms of mishpat tzedek, as a $1 million court case. Why? Because the point is the actions. The point is Hashem's law in society more than necessarily protecting society from the Beis Din. That's one arm of it. That's why we say, that's why an unbelievable fact is that 40 years, sorry, let's see what it is, yes, 80 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Gemara tells us that the Sanhedrin was exiled. Why did the Sanhedrin leave the Lishkas HaGozis? Therefore abating their ability to be able to judge on capital punishment. Why should they do that? So the Gemara says, because nefishi rotzchim, there are many murderers. And your eyebrows should be raised. Really? If there are many murderers, what should they have done? They should open up a second Beis Din, right? Well, that the response is the opposite to the reality. But the point is that no. The point is no. They were there to adjudicate Mishpat Tzedek. And they felt that this would not be Mishpat Tzedek. There were too many people. The expression of Hashem's justice in this case wasn't to be in such a case, because their place wasn't to God's society. Their place was to express Hashem's specific din in society. It takes it further. That's why the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Shabbos say that, this is in source 14, Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kol Dayan Shedon Din Emes La'amitoi, Mashre Shechina B'Yisrael. A judge who is doing the correct judgment in Israel brings the Shechina in, Shenemar Elokim Nitzav Badas Kel B'Ker Elokim Yishpot. This is what we say on Tuesdays in the Shir Shel Yom, that God is standing in the in the Adas Kel in among the judges. The called Dayan she'enod din demes amito gorim shleshkina shetisalag misrael. You see over here, it's not so much about society, but it's about the presence of God within that society which they're upholding. That's the primary function. And Hashem says, if you want to kill another human being, I have a very specific way you do it. It needs to be done in such a way that you can ascertain absolutely that this person is rebelling against God and has acknowledged such a thing and does it in such a fashion. Because that's the only way I give you permission to kill somebody based on my laws. It's almost like the mitzvahs themselves have an expression beyond their societal effect, beyond basic utilitarian principles. And that's what Beis Din is focused on. However, there's a second side to this. And that is the side of the king. And that's why it's interesting, as the Drash Zoran points out, that in Parsha Shoftim there are two leaders of society that are appointed. I'd just like to actually just roll towards the end because we have a few minutes. And that there are two leaders of society. Leader number one is a Shofet, Shoftim v'Shotrim. Leader number two is Somto Simolech Omelech, you shall have a king. And they're both put in the same parasha. Because the king, as the Rambam explains, is somebody who gives judgment, who punishes even without Asra, even without judgment, even without the regular prerequisites as we know them in society. In fact, that is the case of David HaMelech and the Ger HaMoleki. Why was it David HaMelech who killed this man who claimed that he killed Shaul HaMelech? He didn't have Edom, he didn't have Asra. Because what? Because David HaMelech's function was not to punish Mishpat Tzedek, but rather that society should function. That wasn't the point of the Beis Din. And in fact, so therefore you can imagine a case where you would have people come in front of Beis Din, and ad kedei kach, a person runs into the house with a weapon, and you hear what happens, and the man runs out, and the weapon has been used. There's blood on the weapon, the man's dead, there's nobody else in the house. Beis Din could not kill such a person. What would happen? Such a person comes before the king, and he'd be killed. Circumstantial evidence. No, but the king's the one to keep society in check. When the Mishnah in Makos and the Mishnah in Sanhedrin are talking about all the prerequisites, that's in order to get to the end of Mishpat Tzedek, to get to righteous justice. The king wasn't interested in that. The king was interested in keeping society in check. Which means to say that the operational tool of the king was not so much what called basic, the Torah principles per se of Asra, Edim, but based on what? Keeping society in check, which means there's a lot of power vested in the king. Which is why the Torah is so careful about the power of a king. In Saul 16, Vayakishivta kisei malchusoi mamlachtoi v'kosov lois mishnei Torah azos al hasefer milifnei hakohanim aleviim. And he should write the Torah in front of the kohanim. Vayosai mok v'korola kol yemei chayav leman yilmad liyirais Hashem elokov lishmores kol divrei Torah azos v'esachokim o'ele lasosam. Why does he have to have a Torah all his life with him, on his person? Says the Drosh HaSaran, says Rabbeinu Nissim, because of the incredible power which is invested in this individual. He needs to be somebody guided all his life with us. In order that he should have extended love. And there's incredible checks and balances as to the power of a king because of the power vested in such a person. And this really comes to a fore in our case over here with Shlomo HaMelech, because essentially here you have what's happening with Shlomo HaMelech. In the end of the day, he is adjudicating a case, but he's not using the regular methods of what's called halachic reality as we have it. He's using an umdana. But that's the point. The point is because he's the king, he has the ability to do this over here, and this was his, and this was the expression of his wisdom. Sometimes the king has the ability to be able to do something beyond the scope and spectrum of the law in order to be able to keep society in check. I just like to read the short words of this, an incredibly long Drash Zoran, but just the very first words where he describes this, and he says the following. He says Aval be'einai poshut. This is in 17. Poshut pshat hakosav hu yadua hu ki amina enoshi tzorich leshofet sheyishpot bein protov. Every human being needs to have a judicial system, or any society. Remove that judicial system, and you have Lord of the Flies, right? You have a society which breaks down. There's the breakdown, there's anarchy. The world will be destroyed.
Every country needs to have a judicial system. We know that there's a code of pirates, right? Says the Ran. Even pirates, even if you have a society of thieves, they need to have some sort of code. Israel also requires this. But they need another system. To establish the laws of the Torah. To punish based on the laws of the Torah. Even though it has no social ramifications. And therefore you may have two different systems going on. One person may be punished because of true justice. And a person maybe who only has circumstantial evidence and shouldn't be punished, but nevertheless, and there'll be another person who needs judgment, who needs adjudication, not based on what we call a mishpat amiti, but based on the actual needs of the time socially. And this over here is a beautiful model which the Rabbeinu Nissim lays out for us in terms of society as a whole, synthesizing all these different gemaras into a more complex system which perhaps finds its expression in the Mishpat Shlomo of our Hidden Haftarah. Thank you very much, everybody. So, Dibi.